Hello, and welcome to episode 66 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Each year, federal, state, and local governments have to make important budget decisions, and how and where that money gets spent can affect us all. Rick, with so many people struggling to meet even their basic needs, such as food, shelter, healthcare, is it okay for public dollars to fund things that feel, I guess, more optional, such as the arts or sports stadiums and even space travel? How do we weigh those against each other?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to acknowledge that regardless of how important we think the need is for the funding, how the funding is dispersed and used can be done either well or could be done badly. So even money for essential things can be spent so badly that it's basically wasted. And so I think that's the most important thing, is like to take care in how money is dispersed and make sure it is spent wisely. And I have no problem with funding things that go beyond our basic needs. I think we need to do some of those things.
Well, and you know, as I was thinking about this show, I wanted to talk just for a moment about something that many folks are probably familiar with called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. And this just is sort of a five-step identifying things that are terribly crucial to all of us and things that once that's satisfied, we sort of move on to the next set of issues. And the most important in that hierarchy is what's called physiological needs. And that talks about things like air and water and food and shelter, sleep, clothing, reproduction, all things that we individuals need to survive. And frankly, as a society, we need to continue being a society. A step above that are safety needs, things like personal security, health, property, things again, once we have those basic things like food and shelter, we certainly want to feel safe. Step above that is love and belonging, where we have friendship, intimate relationships. Step above that is esteem, which things like respect, self-esteem, status, recognition. And then the top level is self-actualization, and that's simply the desire to become the most that one can be. So I guess I thought that would be a good jumping off point, because although I think all of us would love to have better self-esteem, there's also plenty of us that in this planet that don't even have a safe place to sleep, don't even have a guaranteed food for tomorrow. And there are some people who would say until we meet all of those, until we can check that entire lowest level of the hierarchy of needs and put a complete next to it, we shouldn't move on to that next step. And I think that's probably misguided, but I'm not exactly sure I can say why it is.
Psychologist Ed Diener did a really interesting study, a large survey with many different cultures to see kind of what needs they kind of prioritized and how they were ranked. And what he found, on the one hand, was an affirmation of Maslow's list of needs, that pretty much all the things on this kind of famous pyramid, this hierarchy of needs, are recognized as needs around the world, things that people pursue because they find them essential to some notion of human flourishing. But the ranking is false, because many of these needs we pursue at the same time. I mean, it's simply not true that we have to satisfy our need for food and water and safety before we satisfy our need for friendship or belonging, right, which is two levels higher. And we even know this from our own experience that for babies, for example, which are denied human connection very early, will fail to flourish. They will stop eating and drinking. In fact, pretty much all mammals, if deprived of some kind of connection, will not flourish physically. So which is the prior need here? Is it the human connection, or is it physical needs? And I think in Western societies, we have really been misled by the popularity of Maslow's hierarchy in thinking that we always need to satisfy the physical needs first. And so I'll give you an example. One of the reasons we have such a homelessness crisis right now in our society is not just because we lack housing, it's also because we are very socially fragmented. It's because the United States overall is a very wealthy nation. We have plenty of resources to provide for everybody, but we don't do a very good job of providing for everybody informally through social connections. There are many cultures which are much poorer, do not have nearly the resources, but don't have a problem with homelessness because they take care of one another because they have much stronger social structures. And so that this idea that we need government to provide for these basic things first, it's simply false, and I think it's pernicious.
You know, as you were talking about it, it reminded me of something. There was a book that was published, I don't know, more than 5 years ago, probably less than 10 years ago, called Station 11. Are you familiar with that?
No.
And it was turned into a mini-series about a year ago on HBO. And the premise, and I'm giving nothing away, I promise, is that there is some awful pandemic that sweeps the world. And unlike the one we're just coming out of, like, almost everyone dies. I mean, there's, I don't know what the exact number, but it was less than 1% of humanity is around. And you might think, well, and this, I think, was planned as a miniseries before COVID was on the horizon. So it probably seemed like, is this good timing? Is it not good timing? I don't know. But clearly the scope of it was much, much different. But instead of, and there's been, this is not the first book or a movie to tackle that issue. But what I thought it really did well was it spent much of the time, it did some of the time at the moment of infection, if you will, and how people dealt with that. But that was really just sort of set up. A lot of it was looking at these same groups of people 20 years out and how they were surviving in the world. And obviously there were challenges that we would all understand about trying to survive in a world that's very desolate compared to what we had and many fewer resources. But the reason I thought of that as you described it, and this is a great focus of the book and also the miniseries, is that it follows a group of performers called the Symphony that are doing a loop around Lake Michigan and going out and doing musical numbers, doing Shakespeare, and really trying to give people a deeper meaning to life. And I think the point is that art enriches society in countless ways. And yes, we've all lived through something just about as awful as we could imagine. But let's not forget things like Shakespeare, and let's not forget things like music that can connect us. And if you can remember that after 99.5% of the population is scrubbed from the earth, I think it's also even more important to remember it when most of us are still here. And I think that's maybe the point you were trying to make.
Well, yeah, I think another good example that of what you're talking about is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, where he describes the experience of being in a concentration camp. Very often what he would see is that inmates there would attach so much meaning to a particular date when they thought they might be released, and they would focus on that. And when the date came and they were not released, they would die immediately afterwards. And how much the physical survival depended on people having some kind of connection and some sense of purpose, even in really desperate circumstances. So it's really hard to say the things that provide us with meaning and beauty, experience, you know, activities of creativity or experiences of beauty are really central to our senses of meaning. It's hard to say that they are not fundamental needs.
You mentioned homelessness, and clearly that's a problem in most corners of our country, but I would be hard-pressed to find a state that's not more affected by it than California. And they've tried numerous things in different parts of the state. In some ways, the recent election for mayor of Los Angeles was framed up in a great deal around that issue. And although money can't solve all of the problems with homelessness, it can certainly do a lot of good. At the same time, this discussion's going on the ballot just a couple of weeks ago. There was a Proposition 28, and of course, California is home to lots of ballot referendums that approved $1 billion to fund music and arts education starting next year. And I am sure that, you know, the people who oppose that may have thought that that money could have been better spent, whether it's in the schools or whether we should be not taxing as much or whether we should be tackling homelessness. I don't know. But clearly, the preponderance of voters said, no, in fact, arts education and music education in our school should be a priority. And with all the other problems that California and, frankly, most of our states face, do you agree with a decision like that?
Yeah, I do. We've got more and more evidence all the time of the importance of arts education for students' well-being. In fact, there's good evidence that it increases reading scores and math scores and so forth. And the other thing is, so much of arts education, arts and music, they're the learning of skills that require practice, but they result in the gradual acquisition of competence in doing something where you see the result of it. And so much learning is not like that. I mean, if we're learning history and stuff, it can be fascinating, but you don't feel like you've learned an ability. And so much of youth is expanding our sense of identity through the acquisition of different skills and abilities. Well, this is what the arts do. They give us an opportunity to practice something and get better at something that can be meaningful in such a way. So I don't think it's optional. It's absolutely essential. And the tragedy is that these kinds of programs are often the first ones cut when schools have budget shortfalls, which means that in the poorer school districts, they get much less arts and music education than wealthier school districts.
In preparation for the show, I was chatting with a friend of mine who is a very big advocate for homelessness issues. And he's, although doesn't live in California now, has spent some time in California volunteering at homeless shelters and has seen the huge problem they have out there firsthand. And I asked him this same question, was this the right decision? He wasn't aware of the proposition, but I gave him a story. He read up on it. And I said, do you think voters made the right choice? And he said, yeah, I think they did. But I asked him why, and it was an interesting response. And I think this comes back a little bit more to kind of the topic today, I guess, is how government should decide where to spend its money. His response was, in effect, it always seems like government has enough money to fund the things it cares about. And I think there's some truth to that. I mean, if states were a little different than the federal government, but the federal government is very comfortable, it seems, running huge, huge deficits to pay for things that it feels are important. And I just wonder, though, if that also saves us from making those difficult choices at times where you can't say which is more important, A, B, or C. Well, you'll just pick all three because all probably are fine. And it saves us from making that choice. And again, at state governments and certainly local governments don't have that same deficit spending luxury. But do you think that my friend's right, at least on the federal level, that yeah, if the feds think it's important, they'll just find the money and we don't have to worry about it too much? And is that a dangerous attitude to have in some ways?
I think it's a very dangerous attitude to have because, the money is not inexhaustible. And at some point, we accrue too much debt and future generations are going to have to pay that back. And they're going to have to make even harder choices than we're making right now. The question is, what is a quality education for our kids? If you look at something like the Brookings Institution did a really good study of the importance of arts education for schools. It was a longitudinal study involving a lot of schools comparing those who had art programs and those that didn't, and found really, really beneficial outcome for students in schools with more arts and music education. So then the question is, what's really effective as far as education? And then you ought to fund the things that are most effective. So we have good evidence that, yeah, that's what we should be investing in, because it even makes reading and math scores and all those things better. So it's not, so should we fund, you know, or housing or arts programs? It's, what is the best kind of education program? The other question we often have is, do we take care of adults who are in crisis, or do we make sure that our children are prepared to live kind of healthy and meaningful lives? And I think we often shortchange our children. Investing in our children's well-being ought to be a priority. That comes first. And then we say, okay, and then we have a lot of adults who are having problems. How do we take care of housing and mental health issues and addiction and all of these things that are really serious, but there's also in some ways bottomless pits for funding?
We've talked a little bit, and we'll continue to, about how we make decisions, how public dollars go to fund projects. But I want to just for a second to talk about private donations too, because there's certainly a lot of important work that goes on in private foundations. And, you know, there's a lot of wealthy billionaires, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, more recently Jeff Bezos, who have pledged to donate the vast majority of their incredible wealth to charitable causes. And you look at somebody like Bill Gates, who has, you know, set up this foundation. He and his now ex-wife have done some tremendous work, a lot of that on some of the most basic human needs, you know, where it comes to like childhood vaccinations and mosquito nettings to prevent disease, and things that have really done a great deal of good in reducing the rates of infant mortality in many of the third world countries. And I guess, although probably you and I and no one listening has the same wealth as Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, there are plenty of people who make choices about how to give their money, whether it's to churches or local organizations. And I think the natural inclination oftentimes is to say, yeah, cancer is a really bad thing, but the American Cancer Society gets like billions of dollars all the time. But like down the street, my kids want to go to band camp and they're selling Christmas wreaths this year. And that $50 is really going to have an impact. And maybe let one kid go to camp, and $50 to the American Cancer Society is literally a drop in a huge bucket. Is that the right way to think about those things when you're looking at them individually? Or could the argument be made of, yeah, a kid going to band camp's fine, but like, let's cure cancer?
I don't think it's one or the other. So often, you know, things like kids going to band camp, there's a lot of things that we can do that relatively small amounts of money that support all kinds of good developmental opportunities for kids and improves their social connections and kind of the variety and the interest of the, I would say, of the communities in which they reside. I think that's vitally important for children. We have all of this data now on economic mobility and how what turns out to be so important is the social setting in which children are raised. And so, like, neighborhoods are really important, and how often adults within those neighborhoods are friends with one another, how easy it is to make friends. So I think when I look at my charitable giving, the things that support, first of all, children's well-being, and secondly, strengthening social connections, because that has a direct effect on children's well-being, those are, for me, our priorities. Now, there's other causes that I give to, and I try to, you know, distribute that widely. And I don't have a great deal of money to give. I don't, you know, think that anything I ever donate is going to be make or break for any of these organizations. But I like to do my part in supporting them. And I think that's part of a healthy society in which we all participate in the benefits, you know, of others' largesse, but also we are contributors to it. But I think, you know, kind of in some ways a broad distribution, and then not worry too much. Either, you know, buying Girl Scout cookies, it, you know, it's not going to have much of an impact. But it's really important to support that little girl who's going door to door and learning how to engage in those kinds of social and economic interactions. And so I certainly want to support that.
Well, and Thin Mints are pretty good.
My wife likes them. I could do without them, but I'm still going to buy a box.
Well, your wife is right.
Yeah.
And you are wrong. moving on. I mean, some of the other, I think some people, in some people's minds, music and arts funding in education is somewhat controversial. I don't think that's a large number of people. And certainly as the election showed in California, it's the minority of people. The things that I think are a little more controversial, sports stadiums. And again, it was in the news just the week or so ago that the Kansas City Royals, who have a perfectly nice stadium on the outskirts of the Kansas City Metro, announced that they want to build a brand new, I think it's $2 billion stadium in along the river in the center of the city, and are asking for the public's help in funding the stadium. Their position is that it really won't cost a lot more or any more than the old stadium, because the old stadium needs repairs and modernization, and that would cost so much that we might as well just start over and build a new facility. And this is just but a long history of professional sports teams looking to spend money, often with the public's help, to build these facilities that are owned, all these teams are owned almost exclusively by billionaires and are almost staffed, at least on the players' side, by millionaires, but still asking everybody to chip in for these. Those aren't quite as popular, I think, in many parts of our country. What are your thoughts about funding those projects? Because although there's a lot of pushback, it seems like many of them get the money eventually.
You know, I'm not an economist, and I don't really understand a lot of the analyses. And to be truthful, I haven't looked really carefully into many of the studies of them. But my suspicion is that most of the sports stadiums are boondoggles when it comes to the funding. I don't trust the projections. I mean, if you look at the Kansas City, so they're projecting that this new park will cost $2 billion.
Yeah. A lot of money.
Yeah. Well, you know, the LA stadium, football stadium, which was privately financed, was projected to cost $2.5 billion and ended up costing over $5
billion. Wow.
Now, the part of it was built like as construction costs were going way up due to the pandemic and so forth. But so the projections of the cost are sometimes not reliable. But the estimation that it's going to generate $2.8 billion in total economic output, that it's going to drive 185 more in regional economic output, $60 million in tax revenue. As far as I know, most of these numbers are just false.
And I think you're right. I think from everything I've read, and again, I'm like you, I'm not an expert on this, but from everything I have read, that in almost every case, from a strict economic standpoint, these are not good deals for the taxpayer. But I mean, just to play devil's advocate on that, though, if we're building this, if the city you live in wants to build a skate park, it wants to build a playground, it wants to build a gazebo for the band to play on the weekend, those are also not being built for economic reasons. They're being built for quality of life reasons.
Yep.
And I guess is having a major league sports team in your city that maybe you'll follow on TV, maybe you'll be able to afford a game ticket once in a while, maybe you'll be lucky enough to have season tickets to, isn't that just something that if you live in a large enough city is just sort of a perk about living there?
I'm a big sports fan, and I love having sports, you know, in the city I live in and, you know, in the state and to cheer for. I think it's great. And so if I'm asked to pay a certain amount, I think, you know, if it's hard to know how much am I paying as a taxpayer, you know, for the different sports stadiums. It's hard to know what the numbers actually are. However, when you look at whether it's a wise investment, like for a city, as far as all the other things that could be spent on, think of how many skate parks and museums, libraries, how much housing projects, all of these things that could be done for that $2 billion in Kansas City.
That would also give people jobs. It would also provide people, have an economic impact as well.
And I think it's like a $2 billion really wisely spent in a city like that could be transformative. LA has a brand new $5 billion football stadium. They aren't getting very many hometown fans. They're maybe getting 20-25% of the hometown fans. Most of the fans are cheering for the visiting team. They're coming there to, you know. Why is that? Well, in a lot of these places where there's a lot of other things to do in the cities, they're not always going to the sports. You know, like Miami has trouble, you know, with some of their sports teams, and Jacksonville, these places where there's a lot of outdoor things, San Diego, they have trouble because there's so many other things to do. And I think it would be wise for some of the cities, especially when they're being held hostage by the owner of a pro team, just to say, instead of building a $2 billion stadium, let's study like all the things that really would make this a unique city, greatly improve the quality of life, and let's really invest in it. I think you would have people wanting to live in a place that's really vital and exciting and offers a much better quality of life rather than one that just has a new sports stadium. I was living in Baltimore 25 years ago when Oriel Park was built in downtown, the new Baltimore.
Camden Yards.
Oriel Park at Camden Yards.
Park, yes, yep. Very yep. True, yes.
Yeah, that was a $200 million stadium. That shows you how much the prices have increased.
It was a transformative project, and it changed how baseball stadiums were built from that day on.
And I was really interested because I remember being there. I was a student at Johns Hopkins at the time, and people were, you know, talking about whether that would provide economic input into the city, what it would revitalize the downtown area. And it did a lot to spur economic development in the downtown. And then Andrew Zimbalist and Roger Knoll did an exhaustive analysis of stadiums that were built in the 90s. And their conclusion is that Oriel Park was actually one of the most successful at really fulfilling some of its promises of economic return. But it was the most successful of many failures. Like, none of them delivered what was promised. And the economic return to Baltimore was $3 million per year. And they said that was largely because Washington, D.C. did not have their own professional ball team.
So at that time.
Yeah. Because most stadiums, you're not generating a lot of extra economic input because the people are already living there, who are spending their money, and they're spending it on that instead of other things that they would spend their money on. So you're only getting that economic revenue generation if people are coming from the outside. But then once the Washington Nationals, you know, have relocated in Washington, then they're not getting that. Now, here's the thing. They're getting $3 million per year economic return to Baltimore, but the Maryland taxpayer cost was $14 million per year.
And that was one of the better deals.
That was one of the better because most of them weren't generating even the $3 million. And so that shows like how far off these projections are. I just think there's so many more things that we could do to be enhancing quality of life. And that doesn't mean that sports stadiums shouldn't be built. I think they're highly profitable for the owners. Most teams, if you look at the track record, they have so much increased in value, they can be privately funded.
The other topic I wanted to touch on that is controversial in again funding public funding choices is space travel, and this has been in the news recently because the United States just successfully launched an unmanned rocket to get close to, not land on the moon, but this is just a step, most people say, to returning men on the moon, and hopefully that may even be a practice, if you will, for taking the next long-awaited trip to Mars. It's no surprise at all that all of this costs a ton of money. And there are some that argue, of course, that there are great scientific advances that can come out of this, and that there's also sort of a feel-good dividend there showing the ingenuity that we have and all that we can accomplish. And I think looking back to 1969, when we first put a man on the moon, I don't think even then we realized how remarkable that was, because that whole program was put together in about 11 years, and we got someone safely to and from the moon a few times. The thing that I get stuck on here is that a lot of what we could be doing and all these scientific things that we could learn, could much of that could be done with unmanned ships. And it's obviously you're not putting people's lives at risk, but because you don't have to build in all that safety issues, because you don't have to worry about getting people back, because you don't have to worry about things that are real important for people, like, you know, food and oxygen and air, that you can greatly reduce the cost of these missions and get a lot of the same value out of them. Of course, the romantic notions are not there when you have a robot being remote controlled from Houston, Texas on the moon versus someone like Neil Armstrong taking that, you know, famous step off the lander. So what are your thoughts about this? Is this something that has a place in our priorities and deserves us to spend money on? And at what level do you think is appropriate? And is it really, in your mind, worth it to say, yeah, manned spaceflight is worth that extra risk and worth that extra cost?
Well, what's another $12 billion?
So that's like six baseball stadiums.
Well, yeah. Once you get into these really large figures, frankly, my eyes kind of glaze over. I don't know what it means anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you put that in the context of the federal debt and you say, well, you know, we owe so much money right now that we're spending all kinds of money that we don't have. But then you think, well, given the other things that we're spending money on, is this a worthwhile project? And I go back and forth on it. I agree with you that I think the manned portion is really kind of a romantic notion. It will get a lot of more public interest. Most people, frankly, just aren't interested in hearing about, you know, robots going to the moon, right? And but we have a lot to learn. I think scientists who say, you know, we're going to learn a lot more about the Earth and about our solar system by, you know, picking up moon rocks and analyzing them and seeing if there's, you know, water on the moon, that sort of thing. I think that's all very promising. But you're right. We don't have to have people walking on the moon to collect those samples.
And we can send that data back quickly. And you know, I think we would probably learn a different set of skills in a way that, for better or for worse, may increase our robotic skills as a nation and possibly AI skills as well. I'll make a plug to you and anyone listening. There's a fantastic show out that was out a few years ago that really didn't get a lot of attention. And it's still going. There's season four is being filmed now, but it's on Apple TV, which is not exactly the most watched of our streaming services. But it's called For All Mankind. And is that something you're familiar with?
No, I'm not.
And again, I'm not giving away any secrets to the show here. The opening scene is in 1969. Everybody in America gathered around the TV watching the first person step onto the first surface of the moon. But what you then realize is we were beat to the moon by a couple of months by the Soviets. And this changed the entire trajectory, not only of the space program, but in some ways of the two nations. Mm-hmm. And it really was a space race. And because we had a huge, we were planning on going a couple months later, we still did go as Americans, but it was much more competitive. I won't give away some of the plot twists, but it in some ways brought the country closer together, in some ways brought them further apart. And like any time you have an alternate history show, as this goes on, and I think the last season was up to the 1990s, the ripples of changes become greater because that's just how things go. But just to give one small plot point away in the first episode, as right after the Russians landed on the moon, there was a news report you watch that said the Democrats are very upset about this and are holding Nixon responsible. And in fact, Senator Teddy Kennedy is canceling his vacation to Chappaquiddick to have hearings on this case. So you can see where things yep. may go. So it was an interesting show, and I'd recommend it. Before we end, and to circle back to the topic of the day, as we talk about funding and who gets funding and public funding, the one thing that occurred to me as I was thinking about this is these are decisions made by folks we elect, and whether it's at the local, state, or federal level, they are having to make the best choices they're able to. But I worry that maybe the danger is that the loudest voices oftentimes get the most money. And I think things like space programs and baseball stadiums are almost always going to be louder voices than music classes in schools or homeless people in cities across this country. Is that a challenge that our lawmakers probably face? And do you think they realize they face that?
Oh, I think they do. I think it's like a real, especially from our more responsible lawmakers, it's a real concern how they balance, you know, the loudest demands whether against what they see as the evidence for the greatest needs. And in some ways, that the loudest voices getting what they want is more or less what you both want and expect from a democratic republic, because you want people to come together if they have genuine interest to be able to come together to build coalitions to demand that our representatives pay attention to our concerns and that you show you build a case for what you want, and that's good, and those who can't build a case for it, they end up not getting as much. This leads us often to give fewer resources to children and to people who are in need but have a hard time representing themselves. So this includes the disabled and those who are suffering from mental illness, I think, are often shortchanged in the allocation of these resources. So I think that's an obligation that we have. But otherwise, I think, democracy isn't perfect. It's messy, and it doesn't give us optimal outcomes, but it's certainly better than a tyranny.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me?
Scott, let's say that you are a middle school soccer coach.
Which would be right there a poor choice, by the way. But we'll continue. But anybody who chooses to make me a middle school soccer coach has already made a poor decision.
Scott, let's say that you are a middle school baseball coach.
Okay.
Lately, you have been having problems with some kids showing up to practice late. So you institute a rule that any kid who does not show up on time without a prior excuse will not play in the next game. The day before the biggest game of the year, you have two kids who show up late to a weekend practice. One boy is 10 minutes late. He was routinely late before you instituted the new rule, and his behavior was the chief reason for instituting this new policy in the first place. He probably wouldn't play much. The other boy shows up 20 minutes late. He is your star player. He has never been late before. He bats cleanup and plays first base for you. He explains to you that his mother's car broke down on the way to practice and he had to run several blocks just to get there. What do you do?
So this reminded me, actually, in a previous job I had, they would bring in these people to tell you how to be a better manager. I'll admit that a lot of that stuff, I probably did it either stick with me or I didn't pay as close attention to as I should have. But there is one thing that somebody said that just seemed at first like so wrong. And then I'm like, no, it's absolutely right. And I think it relates to this. I think the scenario she gave, and of course it was a workplace situation, was let's say you have two employees. One employee's fine. And one employee's like one of your best employees. And that employee has some issues around the home. And this employee wants to work four 10-hour days because it just works better for that person's schedule. You've been asked this before, maybe even by this kind of mediocre performer, and always turn down that request. But you have a feeling that in this case, if you don't accommodate this four 10-hour shifts, this person may likely go somewhere else. And of course, you know, and I thought this is where you have a discussion about fairness, and you have to be fair to everybody, and you're the boss, and that's an important characteristic. And she said, no, that's absolutely not true. Because she said there is any workplace of any size at all, everybody gets paid differently. I mean, so there's already an inherent unfairness. I mean, hopefully the people who have been there longer, who are experienced top performers, are earning more than the people who just showed up and are just barely getting by and are still learning on the job. You know, that actually sort of seems fair, right? That you're rewarding the people who do better in different ways. And so her explanation was that it's just fine to accommodate that person who wants to work four 10-hour shifts because it's going to keep that person employed, and that's an important person in your organization. And I thought about this in this particular case in a little bit of a different way, though. So this is middle school baseball. I don't think middle school baseball much matters who wins or loses. I don't think the important skills out of this are how to be better teammates, how to be better players, how to be better people. And as a coach, I would hope that, and again, you might teach them some basic baseball skills, but again, the likelihood is that none of these people are going to make their livelihood playing first base. So I don't much care. I mean, I know your example was that one of these kids is sort of the star and one of these kids is sort of a lackadaisical player. That doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that you have one kid who's always showing up on time and has a very understandable excuse, even though it was after the fact, because everybody's car is broken down at one time in our lives. And this other kid who is showing up consistently late and being disruptive to the rest of the team. And I think in this case, I would like to think that I would not be fair, that I would say, and again, this has nothing to do with, I promise you, the skill level of these young baseball players. It's really trying to send the right message that the kid who is consistently late is, what was your example here, is not going to play in the next game, then he's not going to play in the next game. And if I have a conversation with the mother and find out that, yes, absolutely, she was driving him there and the car broke down and he busted tail to get there as fast as he could, but you know, you can only, there's only so much you can do, that he's going to play the next game. And if people are going to say that's not fair, well, I would say I'm taking into account everything that's happened up until this point. And I think that would be the right decision. And I guess the last thing I'll say in this long soliloquy is I would hope that I would have not made this rule in such a strict way that anybody who is late for practice without a previous excuse is not going to play the next day. I would think I would probably fuzzy that up a little bit more and say, you know, it's kind of up to my discretion, because there will always be cases that cars break down or any myriad of things that may happen that would cause someone to be late, just like sometimes people are late to work and there's a perfectly good reason why. So I don't think I would hopefully not find myself making such a strict rule. But yes, in this case, I would treat these cases differently and not be fair about it.
Yeah, I think your point that you have to be really careful about how you phrase the rule, how you make the rule in the first place, right? And saying something like, you will not play in the next game if you are late without a very good excuse, mm-hmm. instead of just saying without a prior excuse.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
there might be some good reason, like in this case.
Yeah, or your grandpa's funeral seems like a good, I mean, maybe you would know about in advance, but, you know, in the, you know, the hecticness of planning for a funeral, you forgot to call the baseball coach. Well, that's probably fine.
And kids, of course, are really, especially middle school, are really subject to their parents' level of responsibility.
Yes.
Right? So you have to take that into account. I think what's really important is you don't want to send the message that the star player gets preferential treatment and the other players are held accountable.
And that was the most uncomfortable part of this dilemma for me. Mm-hmm. You don't want to feel like you're favoring the star player because, again, that's not why I took this job as a baseball coach, is to win lots of games. I mean, if that happens, great, but I mean, whatever.
And there might be a case to be made for, you have to say, especially if you had stated this rule very forcefully, that there won't be any exceptions, that in that case, you might have to stick with it, but you could also always, like at the end of the year, give that kid a sportsmanship award or mm-hmm, something, mm-hmm. right? For their efforts in getting there. You know, there's other ways of handling this. But I think one thing is to be really important is to avoid the perception that you're playing favorites.
But I mean, to go back to my workplace question about the strong employee yeah. wanting to have a work schedule that maybe others would not be allowed to have, would you have a problem with that?
No, I think I would not have a problem with that, depending on how it was phrased. I think you certainly need to put some guidelines in place for how you make policies and on what basis.
But I mean, sure. But again, assuming that the top performer who's making this request, and we'll stipulate this person's been there for a while and does a good job and has been recognized as that, is getting, and that person's already getting paid more, we think, than somebody who's been there less time, has fewer skills, and isn't as good. I mean, so we have unfairness built into that. So I guess, why do we feel like fairness is so important?
Well, fairness is really important, but I think it's often miscategorized as saying treating everybody exactly the same.
Okay.
It's not treating everybody the same, but it's holding everybody accountable to the same standards. So if you have certain standards of expectation and you say, well, person A is actually being more productive because of their situation, they're being more productive, meeting my workplace expectations on the 4-day, 10-hour days schedule than they would if I required them to be here 5 days. But another person is not going to make those standards in that way, then that would be still fair. They're on different work schedules, but they're being held to the same standard.
I just think that, you know, there's the old idiom that life isn't fair, but I think built into that there is a sort of a quiet assumption that maybe it should be. And I don't necessarily think that's true, meaning that I think we all, in our lives, treat people differently based on our experiences, and maybe that's sometimes good, and maybe that's sometimes absolutely not good. But to say that there should be an expectation of fairness, I think just sets a ridiculously unrealistic view of life, and it's I guess that, you know, that's why people say life isn't fair, but I mean that. To me, that just seems like it goes without saying.
Yeah, I think we should strive to make life reasonably fair. You know, like, so apply standards of fairness within reason. We're just incapable of taking it to an extreme because there's too much that goes on in life that we can't anticipate, that we don't know. So we can't create rules for every eventuality.
Yeah, that's right? Very true. And I sometimes think creating fewer of those backs you into fewer ethical corners.
Yeah, yeah. So there's always a need for judgment in any kind of situation. And I think we end up sometimes being less fair when we don't allow ourselves any room for judgment.
Well, do you know what's good judgment, Rick?
What's that?
That good judgment is to subscribe to The Ethical Life. And you can find that on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And as a reminder, The Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Chris Lay is Lee's podcast operation manager. Be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.